Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Killings of Palestinians by Israeli security forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank have been surging without any accountability, even in the rare case when investigations are announced.
As the reports of violence and killings continue to be reported across the occupied West Bank and in Gaza, despite the ceasefire, we'll go to Ramallah to speak with Israeli-American human rights lawyer Sari Bashi. Then, as a group of eight senators led by Bernie Sanders form a fight club to challenge the leadership of Democratic minority leader Chuck Schumer's handling of Trump, we'll speak with Ralph Nader, who's been taking on the Democratic Party for decades. 60 years ago this week, he published his landmark book, Unsafe at Any Speed, exposing the safety flaws of GM's Chevrolet Corvair and leading to major reforms in auto safety laws.
I'm sure they did the right thing. They found out there was something wrong with the car and they fixed it.
Yes. The question is, why did it take them 4 years to find out? This is my point. Either it's sheer callousness or indifference, or they don't bother to find out how their cars behave.
Ralph Nader is also featured in WTO 99, a new immersive archival documentary about the historic 1999 protests in Seattle against the World Trade Organization, corporate power, and economic globalization.
135 nations are gathering in Seattle for the World Trade Organization meeting.
The TV stations, they're not informing people why there is a protest. This explains why there is a protest.
My personal reason for marching is because I want to see fair labor practices.
Globalization has already gone too far.
We'll speak with the film's director, Ian Bell. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is attempting to distance himself from the first U.S. airstrike on September 2nd that targeted two shipwrecked men who'd survived an earlier U.S. strike on a boat the Pentagon says was carrying drugs, though they have not provided evidence. Legal experts say the strike was likely a war crime. Last week, The Washington Post reported Hegseth had given a verbal order to, quote, kill everybody on the boat. Hegseth spoke Tuesday during a White House cabinet meeting.
I watched that first strike live. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting. A couple of hours later, I learned that that commander had made which he had the complete authority to do. And by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat.
Hegseth was sitting next to President Trump during the three-hour cabinet meeting in which Trump appeared to fall asleep a number of times. Since September, the U.S. has bombed at least 21 boats in the Caribbean Sea and Pacific Ocean, killing more than 80 people. Meanwhile, the family of a Colombian fisherman killed in a U.S. boat strike on September 15th has filed a complaint against the U.S. with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The family of Alejandro Carranza Medina says he was the victim of an extrajudicial killing. In more news from the region, a bipartisan group of lawmakers has introduced a war powers resolution to block the Trump administration from engaging in hostilities against Venezuela without congressional authorization. Israel's announced that it plans to reopen the Rafah border crossing as part of the U.S. brokered ceasefire, but only to allow Palestinians to leave Gaza. According to the World Health Organization, more than 16,500 sick and wounded people need to leave Gaza for medical care. This comes as Israel says the partial remains returned by Hamas do not match the two hostages remaining in Gaza. Palestinian militants are reportedly struggling to find the remains amidst the rubble. Meanwhile, Israel's continued its drone strikes in Gaza, killing Palestinian photojournalist Mahmoud Wadi in Khan Yunis. This is his father, Issam Wadi.
As a father, I received the news with shock. It was like an earthquake at home. I live in a tent. The tent was blown away when I lost my son. He was hit in an abnormal strike, which we weren't expecting on a day like this.
President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and son-in-law Jared Kushner met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow for nearly 5 hours Tuesday, but a deal to end the war in Ukraine was not reached. Russian officials described the talks as constructive, but said, quote, no compromise was reached on certain issues. Earlier today, Germany's foreign minister criticized Russia, saying he had seen, quote, no serious willingness on the Russian side to enter into negotiations, unquote. Meanwhile, the European Union's agreed to ban natural gas from Russia by late 2027. On Tuesday, Putin warned Europe that Russia was ready for war if it's provoked. This comes as NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte vowed to keep up the supply of U.S. weapons to Ukraine.
The best way to put pressure on the Russians is by doing two things. One is making sure that the Russians understand that the weapon flow into Ukraine will keep on going. That's exactly what's happening today. Thanks to the U.S., thanks to the Europeans, U.S. sending its crucial gear to Ukraine, paid for by Canada and European allies.
New details are emerging about President Trump's decision to pardon former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was released from prison Monday. Hernandez was sentenced last year to 45 years in prison for trafficking hundreds of tons of cocaine into the United States. In October, Hernandez wrote a four-page letter to Trump seeking a pardon, claiming he'd been unfairly targeted by the Biden administration. The letter was delivered by longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone. Some Republican lawmakers have openly criticized Trump's decision. This is Republican Senator Tom Tillis, who said, quote, it's a horrible message. It's confusing to say on the one hand, we should potentially even consider invading Venezuela for a drug trafficker, and on the other hand, let somebody go, unquote. It's unclear if Hernandez will attempt to stay in the United States or return to Honduras. On Tuesday, some Hondurans in the capital, Tegucigalpa, criticized Trump for freeing Hernandez and for meddling in Sunday's election.
I'm against everything that is happening because it's an insult to Honduras, because Honduras really doesn't deserve this. That's because of a political aversion. They come and do this to our country with all the damage Juan Orlando caused here in Honduras. So all of us as Hondurans feel mocked because another country comes to interfere in what we should be doing here in our own country.
This all comes as Honduras continues to count votes from Sunday's presidential election. The centrist Salvador Nasralla has taken a slim lead over the conservative Nasri Asfura, who has been backed by Trump. On social media, Trump has claimed without evidence the Honduran election officials are trying to change the results of the race. The Pentagon's inspector general set to release a report Thursday examining Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's sharing of sensitive information about U.S. strikes on Yemen in a signal group chat earlier this year. The group chat, which included other senior members of the Trump administration, was revealed after Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic magazine, was accidentally added. According to Axios, a full version of the report has been sent to the Senate Armed Services Committee. The Trump administration's launching an ICE operation to target hundreds of Somali immigrants in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region, according to reporting by The New York Times. An official speaking to The Times says nearly 100 immigration officers and agents from around the country have been tapped for the operation. The directive comes shortly after President Trump lashed out at the Somali community during a cabinet meeting, calling them garbage that he does not want in the country.
I hear they ripped off Somalians, ripped off that state for billions of dollars, billions, every year, billions of dollars, and they contribute nothing. The welfare is like 88%. They contribute nothing. I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you, okay? So we could go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage.
Democratic Congress member Ilhan Omar responded to President Trump's attack in a post on social media saying, quote, his obsession with me is creepy. I hope he gets the help he desperately needs, Congressmember Omar said. Meanwhile, the Trump administration announced its paused green card and U.S. citizenship processing for immigrants from 19 countries already subject to a travel ban put in place earlier this year. This follows the Trump administration's announcement it's pausing all asylum decisions for immigrants currently in the U.S. after an Afghan national has been charged with murdering a National Guard member and critically injuring another in Washington, D.C. last week. He's pleaded not guilty. The Trump administration fired 8 immigration judges here in New York City Monday, according to the National Association of Immigration Judges. The fired judges worked at 26 Federal Plaza, which also houses the New York City headquarters for ICE. Since President Trump's return to office, more than 100 immigration judges out of about 700 have been fired or pushed out. The Trump administration is threatening to withhold money for food benefits under SNAP, that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, in most Democratic-controlled states next week, unless they share information on who exactly is receiving those benefits. Earlier this year, the Agriculture Secretary had requested the information to verify the eligibility of 42 million recipients. Soon after, 22 states and the District of Columbia sued the U.S. Department of Agriculture over the request. In October, a federal judge issued a temporary injunction that prevents the Department of Agriculture from demanding the data of recipients and cutting SNAP funds. On Tuesday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul wrote on social media, quote, genuine question. Why is the Trump administration so hell-bent on people going hungry? She asked. In health news, a federal vaccine panel is preparing to vote this week to end the practice of vaccinating all newborns for hepatitis B. The panel, which was handpicked by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is also expected to discuss making other major changes to the childhood immunization schedule. Sean O'Leary of the American Academy of Pediatrics criticized the move, saying, quote, any changes they do make could be devastating to children's health and public health as a whole, he said. A federal judge in Boston has blocked the Trump administration from cutting Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood and its affiliates across 22 states. The Democratic-led state sued the Trump administration back in July after the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill contained a provision that barred Medicaid reimbursements to nonprofits that provide abortion. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani said the law would, quote, increase the percentage of patients unable to receive birth control and preventive screenings, thereby prompting an increase in states' health care costs, unquote. Planned Parenthood responded to the ruling saying, quote, the district court again recognized the defund law for what it is, unconstitutional and dangerous, they said. The Trump administration's reversing the reinstatement of 14 FEMA workers who signed a petition earlier this year warning the cuts to the agency were putting the U.S. at risk of repeating the mistakes made during the response to Hurricane Katrina. Soon after they signed the letter back in August, FEMA suspended the workers. Last Wednesday, they were reinstated, but hours later, they were suspended again. Jeremy Edwards, a former FEMA official who signed the Katrina declaration, said that the back and forth over the status of the FEMA workers, quote, represents the type of dysfunction and inefficiency that's plagued FEMA under this administration, unquote. Former U.S. Treasury Secretary, former Harvard President Larry Summers has been banned from the American Economic Association over his close ties to the late Jeffrey Epstein. Recently revealed emails show Summers stayed in close contact with Epstein long after the convicted sex offender's 2008 conviction. In Tennessee, the Republican Matt Van Epps has defeated Democrat Afton Bain in a closely watched special election for a U.S. House seat. Van Epps won the race by around 9%, a far smaller margin than Trump's 22-point victory in the district last year. And more than 1,350 people have now died in devastating floods and landslides in Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and Thailand. Hundreds are still missing. Sri Lanka's president described the flooding as the, quote, largest and most challenging natural disaster in our history, unquote. In Indonesia, the death toll has topped 700. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel has announced it will reopen the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt in the next few days as part of the U.S. brokered ceasefire. According to the World Health Organization, at least 16,500 sick and wounded people need to leave Gaza for medical care. However, the border will only open in one direction, for Palestinians to exit. Since the ceasefire began, at least 347 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza and 889 injured, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. In one recent incident, two children were killed by an Israeli drone for crossing the so-called yellow line, which isn't always well marked. The children were brothers Fadi and Juma Abu Asi, the older of whom was 10 years old. They were gathering firewood for their disabled father. The Israeli military acknowledged the strike, saying, quote, the Air Force eliminated the suspects in order to remove the threat, unquote. Palestinians report Israeli forces continue to cross the yellow line on a near daily basis. This week, a coalition of 12 Israeli human rights groups concluded in a new report that 2025 is already the deadliest and most destructive year for Palestinians since 1967. On Monday, Israeli forces killed two teenagers in the West Bank in separate attacks as they carried out raids across the territory. In Hebron, soldiers fatally shot 17-year-old Mohamed Tariq Mohamed Al-Zugair, whom they accused of carrying out a car ramming attack that injured an Israeli soldier. Elsewhere, 18-year-old Mohamed Raslan Mahmoud Asmar was shot during a raid on his village northwest of Ramallah. Witnesses say the teen was left to bleed out as Israeli forces barred Red Crescent medics from approaching. The soldiers then seized his lifeless body. Last week, the UN reported more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli settlers and soldiers in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem since October 7, 2023. This is Jeremy Lawrence, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Killings of Palestinians by Israeli security forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank have been surging without any accountability, even in the rare case when investigations are announced. Our office has verified that since the 7th of October 2023 and up until the 27th of November of this year, Israeli forces and settlers killed 1,030 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Among these victims were 223 children.
For more, we're joined in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank by Sari Bashi, an Israeli-American human rights lawyer, former program director at Human Rights Watch. Her piece for the New York Review of Books is headlined Gaza, The Threat of Partition. She co-founded Gisha, the leading Israeli human rights group promoting the right to freedom of movement for Palestinians in Gaza. Sari, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's begin with the latest breaking news that Israel in the next few days will open the Rafah border crossing, but only for Palestinians to go one way out. What is your response?
So, obviously, people need to leave. You mentioned the numbers of thousands of patients waiting to leave. There are also students who've been accepted to universities abroad. This is after all of Gaza's universities have been destroyed. So, it's half good news. But the bad news is that the Israeli announcement that it will not allow people to return to Gaza validates the fears that many have, that the ceasefire plan, the American plan, and the Israeli plan is essentially to continue the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So in Trump's ceasefire plan, he committed to allowing Palestinians to return to Gaza, but that's not what's happening on the ground. There has been no construction authorized in the half of Gaza where Palestinians actually live. There has been no ability for people to come back home, and there are people who want to come back home. And life in Gaza is nearly impossible for people because of very, very bad conditions. 81% of buildings have been destroyed. People are living in tents that are now flooding in the rain. And it is very difficult to get construction and other materials approved by the Israeli authorities.
Sorry, there have also been reports of secret evacuation flights from Gaza. Who is running these flights and who determines who goes on those flights?
I mean, that's part of the problem. Early in the war, the Israeli government created what it calls the Voluntary Emigration Administration, which is a secret, non-transparent government body that is supposed to encourage people from Gaza to leave and make it possible for them to do so. There has been almost no transparency about what that organization is doing. There has been deliberate disinformation by Israeli ministers trying to artificially amplify the number of people leaving Gaza to make people afraid. And there have been persistent reports about people paying large sums of money in order to leave. And that is after they have reportedly been asked to sign commitments not to return. On the other hand, there is a very clear statement in the Trump peace plan, which was incorporated into a UN Security Council resolution, that people in Gaza are to be allowed to return home. And it's perhaps not surprising that following the Israeli announcement this morning that Rafah crossing would be opened for exit only, the Egyptian government reportedly issued an objection and said no. It reminded us that the U.S. had promised that people in Gaza would be allowed to come home as well.
And could you talk some about the situation in the West Bank, as we've reported these constant attacks by settlers and the military? What's been the position of the Israeli government on this, and what role have the military played in these attacks?
I mean, the concern is that the violence in Gaza, the violence in the West Bank, it's not random. It's directed toward ethnic cleansing. It's directed toward getting Palestinians to leave. Certainly, that's the case in Gaza, and the devastation and violence there are at a much higher scale than in the West Bank. But in the West Bank, too, just this year, we've had 2,000 Palestinians forcibly displaced from their homes through a combination of demolitions as well as settler violence. Every single day, Palestinians are injured or their property is damaged by settler attacks. And to be clear, settlers are Israeli civilians who have been unlawfully transferred to the occupied West Bank by the Israeli government and have been taking over land that belongs to Palestinians. In the last 2 years, they have become increasingly emboldened in attacking Palestinians, taking over their olive groves, their flocks, stealing, throwing firebombs into their homes, to the point where, according to the UN, in 2025, 1,000 Palestinians have been injured by settler attacks. This is decentralized violence, but it is also state-sponsored violence. It is the government who put those settlers in the West Bank unlawfully, and quite often this violence takes place when Israeli soldiers either stand nearby and do nothing or even participate. A very ultranationalistic, messianic ideology has been infiltrated into the Israeli military, where you have soldiers whose job it is to protect everybody, including Palestinians, who are also settlers. And on the weekends, they come out in civilian clothing and attack and sometimes even kill Palestinians.
And what about the Jewish and Israeli Jewish activists who stand alongside Palestinians to prevent the olive harvest from being destroyed, to prevent people from being attacked, the response of the Israeli military and the settlers?
You know, it's an indication of just how badly things have gotten, how many red lines have been crossed, because it used to be that Jewish settlers would be reluctant to attack Jews because their ideology is racialized. They believe that they are acting in the name of the Jewish people. But recently, they have attacked Israeli Jews as well, when Israeli Jews have come to accompany and be in solidarity with Palestinians. So we just finished the olive harvest season. It's a very important cultural and also economic event for Palestinians. And this year it was particularly violent with Israeli settlers coming, attacking people as they tried to harvest, cutting down and burning down trees, intimidating people. And there have been cases even where Israeli Jewish activists came to be a protective force by accompanying Palestinian harvesters. And they too were attacked and even taken to the hospital with injuries. It is much more dangerous to be a Palestinian than to be an Israeli Jew in the West Bank. But the fact that settlers are also attacking Jews is an indication of just how violent, messianic, and ultranationalistic this movement has become.
The death toll from Israel's more than two-year assault on Gaza has been reported as 70,000. A new study from the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research in Germany said the death toll likely exceeds 100,000. Our next guest, Ralph Nader, has talked about the Lancet report, saying it's probably hundreds of thousands. Life expectancy, says the Max Planck Institute in Gaza, fell by 44% in 2023, 47% in 2024. If you can talk about this, and also what is going to happen in Gaza now, where the truce stands.
I mean, the violence against people in Gaza has been unprecedented. It's been genocidal. And, you know, we have confirmed 70,000 people whose names and ID numbers have been reported by their families to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. There are thousands more people believed to be buried under the rubble, and thousands or tens of thousands of people who died from indirect causes. So these are people who, because of a deliberate policy of starvation, died of malnutrition, died of communicable diseases, died of want. And I don't know that we will ever know how many people died indirectly. This is for a very small population. It's a population of 2 million people. In Gaza right now, life has remained nearly impossible. The ceasefire promised reconstruction. It promised the crossings to be open. But the U.S. government introduced a number of caveats, and it actually, unfortunately, got those caveats approved by the U.N. Security Council. And an important caveat was that the reconstruction elements of the ceasefire would be limited to areas where Hamas had had disarmed. And if the Israeli military was not able to disarm Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups in 2 years of war, it's not clear how they're going to be disarmed now. So conditioning reconstruction on Hamas disarmament is basically saying reconstruction will be impossible. The only place where the U.S. has said it will allow reconstruction is in the more than 50% of Gaza that is directly occupied by Israel, that is off limits to Palestinians on penalty of death. So that doesn't leave people in Gaza with any options. 600,000 school children have no schools. The hospitals are barely functioning. There's nowhere to live. 1.5 million people are in need of emergency shelter supplies. The concern is that the way the ceasefire is being implemented is only going to contribute to ethnic cleansing, because anybody who can leave Gaza will leave, because it's very clear that there's not a future being allowed there. And the United States has an opportunity to make good on its promise in two ways. First of all, it can make it clear that reconstruction has to be authorized in the part of Gaza where Palestinians live, not in the half of Gaza that's off limits to them. And second of all, it should demand, as per the ceasefire agreement, that Rafah be open in both directions, also to allow people to come home.
And I wanted to ask you how the Israeli media is reporting both the breaches in the constant breaches in the ceasefire agreement, as well as the constant attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank, and what's been the impact on public opinion since the ceasefire came into effect, Israeli public opinion.
You know, I'm very sorry to say that there's been a long-term trend of the Israeli media becoming more nationalistic and less critical, and that's been matched by a number of government moves to co-opt and take over both public and private media. So particularly since October 7th, 2023, the Israeli media, with a few notable exceptions, has been reporting government propaganda uncritically. So what you will hear in the Israeli media is that suspects were shot in Gaza for crossing the yellow line or approaching troops. You won't hear that those suspects were 10 and 12-year-old boys who were collecting firewood, and that under international law, you can't shoot children because they cross an invisible line. In the West Bank, you will hear that terrorists were taken out, when you mean ordinary civilians who were trying to harvest their olive trees. There, Haaretz and a few other media outlets have been offering a different view of what's happening, a more realistic view. But right now, many Israelis choose not to see what's happening either in the West Bank or Gaza. And interest in what's happening in Gaza has gone way down since the majority of Israeli hostages have